From KUER News in Salt Lake City, this is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Some of you are going to know who Jesse Thorne is. He's, well, runs a podcast network. He created a menswear blog. He's a San Francisco Giants fan. He loves hip-hop. And he's a radio guy. Maybe that's why the name sounds familiar. He has an NPR show called Bullseye. That's the new name. It used to be called The Sound of Young America, which he conceived in college. It's interviews mostly about culture and music and comedy. Their old slogan gets at it pretty well, a public radio show about things that are awesome. Jesse's smart and he's funny, and we figured it would be fun to talk to him about the media landscape, the cultural landscape, and what it means to dress like a grown-up. Jesse Thorne today, after the news.
We want to take a moment to shout out The Good Line for supporting this podcast. If you're building a brand, these guys can help you with websites, film, design. They're all about finding and telling stories that bring together a full brand experience. Check out the new Radio West Films website to find out what that means, or you can see what else they do at thegoodline.com.
This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. I first started listening to Jesse Thorne, it's been several years now, when the name of his podcast slash public radio show was called The Sound of Young America. I remember at first feeling kind of suspicious about the title, like it was going to have some tiresome pretense about speaking for a generation or something, but it's a really good show, not just because Jesse is a thoughtful interviewer, asks really good questions, but I've always thought of the show as being useful. He and his guests recommend movies and albums and books. In that sense, Jesse is a curator of American popular culture and also of menswear, if you can believe it. Some of you may know the men's style blog he started a few years ago called Put This On. These days, his radio show is called Bullseye. He changed the name when NPR started distributing it a few years ago. And today in the program, Jesse Thorne is joining us. In addition to hosting and producing Bullseye, Jesse hosts the podcasts Judge John Hodgman, with the actor and humorist John Hodgman, of course, and also you may recognize Jordan Jesse Go. That's a podcast he has with his college pal Jordan Morris. He founded an independent radio production group called MaximumFun.org, which features more than a dozen podcasts now. We've got links to all of that on our website, RadioWest.org. Jesse is joining us today from member station KPCC in Pasadena. And Jesse, welcome. Thanks very much for doing this.
Thank you so much for having me, Doug.
So I don't know if you were able to hear a little bit of the public radio fun drive there before. Don't you love fun drive time?
I think everyone loves fun drive time, right?
Did you do your share of pitching? I mean, have you? I mean, I imagine you have.
Well, MaximumFun.org, my podcast network, is supported by donations, and we have something called the Max Fun Drive once a year.
Right.
And that's besides my, you know, my side gig pitching on public radio stations that carry Bullseye. I mean, the truth is, honestly, Doug, you know, on the one hand, it's a bummer that time that could be taken up by, you know, great public radio content is taken up by the pledge drive. On the other hand, I found anyway with our pledge drives that it's the time of year that I get the most connection with our audience. And I really appreciate it, you know, because it's people giving money that don't have to give money.
Right.
They're choosing to give money because they want to support what you're doing. And that is a really – that's a really powerful thing as somebody who makes stuff.
Yeah. I mentioned described you as a curator before. I wonder, what do you think about that? I mean, then the idea of the program being useful. Do you like that idea?
Yeah. Well, yeah. I mean, I think, you know, when I try and explain what Bullseye is to people, I try to emphasize that we think of it as a recommendation show.
Right.
You know, certainly it takes the form substantially of long-form interviews, but we don't have anyone on Bullseye that we don't think does amazing work. And we don't book people on Bullseye because they have fascinating life stories. We book people on Bullseye because they do things that are amazing. And we want to talk to them about creating, essentially. And so, yeah, I mean, we're not always going for the most famous person, you know, or, you know, the person with the craziest life. We're going for the person that whose stuff we like the best.
Hmm. I'm trying to imagine your upbringing. You're from San, I mean, you're from San Francisco. You grew up in the Mission District.
Yeah.
So I'm getting a sense you must have been really involved in kind of the mix of that city, taking in all kinds of influences. I mean, did you wander around a lot?
Yeah. In fact, you know, it's funny. I was just talking about this with my therapist the other day. But we were trying to figure out why I was so deeply upset by the changes that have happened in the neighborhood where I grew up in San Francisco, which has essentially, in the time since I was a teenager, gone from gentrified to gentrifier. What's his name? The Facebook guy, Mark Zuckerberg. He built a $4 million house like 6 blocks from where I lived, where I always had to be careful of what colors I wore. The thing that my therapist suggested to me was that, in some ways I had a difficult family life. And so the place that I am from was in some ways a family to me or a parent to me. And I think I was also raised to see the world that way. Both of my parents, my parents were divorced since I was very young, but they both lived in that neighborhood, and they both chose that neighborhood because it was a place that had a sense of connection and place and community that, you know, they couldn't have found for me if I had grown up in, San Mateo, California, or Hillsboro, or some other suburban place.
I don't know anything about your mother, but I've read just little bits and pieces here and there. Used to run a clothing boutique in D.C. back in the 70s.
She did. Yeah, that's true. My mom's had a lot of lives. But one of them was she ran a boutique in D.C. in the 70s. My mom's from D.C. And one of the things she did was sell clothes there. And the story in my family, I have not independently verified it, but the story in my family is that she made a lot of clothes for Miles Davis during his more wild sartorial years.
Right.
Post Ivy League. Miles Davis. Yeah, my mom is a trip. You know, my mom, when I was a little kid, she was she worked in retail. She worked at an antique lighting store. And when I was about, about eight or 10, she went to graduate school in Latin American studies at San Francisco State. And eventually it took until I was in my mid-teens. So I was 15 or 16, I think. She became a junior college professor. But yeah, she's really a piece of work, my mom. Well, my dad, too. I have intense roots.
Yeah, you do. I'm thinking about, I read where she would take you to these thrift shops around town, which got me thinking about, and we'll come back to it a little bit later when we're talking more about the menswear style, put this on, because I do want to ask you about that. But you loved going thrifting. I do know that. And I'm guessing, did it start with mom? It must have, right?
Yeah, you know, my mom's, the antique store that my mom worked at was on Fillmore Street in San Francisco, which is now, I think, more purely Tony. But at the time, it was kind of the bridge between Pacific Heights, where the legitimately rich people in San Francisco live, you know, Daniel Steele and stuff. And George Shultz. And the Fillmore, which was historically an African-American neighborhood. And so what it had, in addition to the antique store at which my mom worked, was the best thrift stores in the city. Because it had, and it to some extent still has, you can tell I'm getting excited just talking about this.
I can't.
It had the thrift store for the symphony, the thrift store for the opera, and the thrift store for the like fancy private boys' school.
Yeah.
And if you're thrift store shopping, you want to be thrift store shopping where the rich people are leaving off their stuff. But yeah, I mean, I don't think my mom or my dad, for that matter, bought me more than, you know, I don't think more than 15% of my wardrobe until I was an adolescent was purchased new.
Yeah. I can't tell if you were a public radio nerd when you were a kid. I mean, I get the sense that you listened to probably your share of public radio, but I also get the sense that in some ways you got a little tired of the form. And it seems like part of your interest in doing radio, what you came to, was trying to shake it up a bit, try to do something new or different. Do you think that's right?
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I certainly grew up listening to public radio. In my free time as a kid, I mostly listened to sports radio. But both of my parents were public radio listeners. And, you know, I'd never resented public radio in the way that some kids do. But, you know, and to some extent, I grew up loving – I remember really loving the CBC show Quirks and Quarks, for example.
Yeah.
But – you know, I think as a teenager, when I was maybe 16, maybe I was 15, This American Life started running on KQED and KALW in San Francisco. And when I heard This American Life, the first thing that I thought was, this is weird.
Yeah.
Then I got used to it. And the next thing that I thought was, oh, maybe public radio could be more than what I think of it as.
Right.
And, you know, it was great at the things that I was thinking of it as. It was great as, you know, an in-depth news source. But it occurred to me that there might be something that had a cultural perspective that was more distinctive. And, you know, like it's not even that This American Life was my cultural perspective. Like, you know, Ira's 20 years older than I am.
Yeah.
But it was more that he had the courage to do something that had a really strong personal voice. And I loved it right away. I mean, I get migraine headaches, and when I take my migraine medication, which is all too frequently, I'm sort of semi-incapacitated.
Yeah.
And I, you know, in college, I remember sitting in my dorm room listening to This American Life from the Real Player stream on thisamericanlife.org. And I literally listened to every episode of the show.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I ended up doing a public radio show, I thought, what if I could do a show that was reflective of the things that I thought were really wonderful about public radio, which, you know, I think had to do with values, but came from a perspective that I connected more deeply with, which is to say my perspective.
Yeah, well, I think you described in one interview I read, you said you were hoping there was room for a David Letterman type show but also had a little Charlie Rose in it. Is that it?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't think I have ever been prouder of myself than in like 2006 or something like that. Long ago, when I was still living in San Francisco, I was doing the show on a mixing board in my living room. I was podcasting the show, and there was an article in Salon that said I was like Terry Gross meets Conan O'Brien. And that has literally been in – that's been in the podcast description of the show ever since. I think it's still in there now 8 years later.
Right.
Because I'm like, yeah, sure, that's what I'm shooting for.
Yeah. Well, you are clearly – I mean, when you listen to the – if you listen to the podcast or the radio show, I mean, you're passionate about comedy. You've talked about how important that is in your life. And in fact – You say you've never really paid the bills by being a comic, but you have been paid to do comedy.
That's true.
was it stand-up? Was it conventional? I mean, what was it?
I did sketch. Jordan Morris, who is my co-host on Jordan Jesse Go and is now a writer on At Midnight on Comedy Central, he and I had an improv group in college. And then in just after I had graduated from college, I was still doing the show in Santa Cruz on my college radio station, driving back and forth from San Francisco. Right. And we had this amazing, brilliant sketch comedy group called Casper Hauser on. And they were then and are still now comedy heroes of mine. And we played on the air a couple of bits that we had made for The Sound of Young America, which before I was the sole host, had a lot more comedy stuff on it.
Yeah.
And they said, "Oh, this is really good. Have you guys ever done any shows in San Francisco? We could probably get you a booking." And Jordan said, "Oh, that sounds great." And we had no sketch. We had no show.
Yeah.
So we put together a sketch comedy group that called Prank the Dean that we toured to. There's a real sketch comedy scene around the country with festivals and stuff like that. And
yeah.
They all pay enough money that, like, you come home at the end of a weekend of shows with $100.
Yeah.
And, you know, your plane ticket and lodging having been paid for. But there isn't much money in sketch comedy beyond that. At least there wasn't before web video was as big as it is now.
So it seems like the Sound of Young America was you wanted it to be a sketch show in the early days. I mean, you were writing bits. But that's
yeah,
a,
I mean,
there's a
the
lot
Sound of Young
work.
America, The Sound of Young America was kind of an omnibus show.
Yeah.
My initial idea was maybe we could do like a funny This American Life. And then I produced one This American Lifestyle segment. And I was like, oh, boy, I'm not doing this again.
Right.
That's like 10 minutes. That's like 10 minutes of content. And it took me like 3 weeks.
Yeah.
So we ended up doing a sort of combination of comedy bits, interviews, We would do the occasional audio play. We would kind of stay up all night the night before writing it and just cast people that we found around campus in it. Eventually what happened is, you know, Jordan and my other co-host, Gene, graduated from school and moved to Southern California to work in show business. Gene's also a comedy writer. And I was still in San Francisco where there was no way to pursue a comedy career. So I just sort of took the one part of The Sound of Young America, the interviews that I could do completely by myself, mm-hmm. and made that the show. And then later when I moved to Los Angeles, you know, Jordan was around and we started Jordan Jesse Go as a sort of place to put all of the comedy that we'd been doing on The Sound of Young America.
I wonder what it was like, when you decided to change the name of the show, NPR became interested, although you had to pitch it to them. And I'm wondering, what did you have to change or give up in that process? Because you've talked about how in the conversations you're having with NPR, you had talked about the stuff that the show covers isn't necessarily, this is how you put it in one interview, isn't really in the wheelhouse of people who make programming decisions in public radio. So what was the pitch like? And what did you say that made it work?
You know, the cool thing is that the folks who are running it sort of worked out perfectly. I was coming to the end of the line with PRI, who had distributed the show previously, mm-hmm. and I didn't really know anyone at NPR. But it turned out that the guy who runs non-news programming at NPR was relatively new. And he had just been working on developing Snap Judgment with Glenn Washington, mm-hmm. and had been working on developing Ask Me Another, which was co-hosted by Jonathan Colton, who's a good friend of mine. And so I sent him an email out of the blue, like completely out of the blue, and said, you know, I think I'm going to want a new distributor for my show. Have you ever heard it? And he said, well, I'm coming to Los Angeles next week. Let's talk. And, you know, NPR is doing some really remarkable stuff in the way that I think they're really in the past few years, they've really taken seriously their mandate to think about what will public radio be not just in this moment and not just reflective of the past, but what will it be in the future?
Yeah.
And they're putting real resources towards that, putting real resources towards diversifying their programming. I think it's really fantastic. I mean, I feel lucky. In some ways, I feel more connected to stuff like NPR's Code Switch blogs about race, or NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, which is a really wonderful podcast that they do with – that's hosted by Linda Holmes, who writes the really great NPR pop culture blog, Monkey See. You know, it's sort of this experimental side of NPR that I'm actually – they were excited to have me on board. Like, they were into it, which I had no idea.
Yeah. I'm wondering what you're seeing out there that you like, not just in podcasts, but what's the stuff that's working, do you figure? I mean, you've got the more highly produced shows, you know, long-form narrative journalism, Radiolab, obviously, This American Life. Then there's the chatty stuff, you know, as you've described it, the ones where there's just people just sitting around talking. Some of those are really great. I mean, depending on the – I mean, what are the elements – do you think that you need to make this work? Is it a combination of these, or do you have to pick one and go for it?
I think to some extent you have to pick one.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, I know there certainly has been a change in tone in the highly produced audio that you hear on public radio. And the highly produced audio that you hear on public radio is pretty much the only highly produced audio that you hear.
Right.
So, you know, I think This American Life has so transformed the landscape of radio that you find that, you know, even a news report from a local station that runs on All Things Considered has a little bit of This American Life in it, in terms of the narrative focus and, you know, the subject matter and the tone of the host.
Right.
So certainly there has been in some ways a kind of casualization of the highly produced content. But there's a big difference between that and, you know, Jordan, Jesse, Go, which is, you know, two guys and a comedian sitting around making very silly, very vulgar jokes, you know. I think what you need to succeed in the new media world is something that connects with people very powerfully, and that is a contrast with what you needed historically. What you needed historically was just something that was just compelling enough that people wouldn't change the channel. There's just a big difference between something that you pick and something that washes over you.
Mm-hmm.
And both of them can totally have merit, but they're different things. You know, those chatty shows, the strength that they have, and even the relatively chatty newsy shows like This American Life, their big strength is that they form a personal connection between the host and the audience. And, you know, podcasting, you know, radio is a particularly personal and intimate medium. And podcasting, I think, is even more so. And so you have a show like, for example, WTF, you know, with Marc Maron, which we produced the public radio version of. You know, Mark is an absolutely remarkable guy.
Yeah.
You know, he's a friend of mine. He's a brilliant comedian, but he's also he's just a captivating personality. You know, he draws you in with his – specifically with his neuroses.
Exactly. We should point out you taught him how to podcast.
Well, that's a stretch.
Is it?
That's a stretch. I feel bad. I feel like people give me too much credit for Mark's show. Mark had a long history of working at Air America, including hosting their morning show for a number of years.
Yeah.
And he and his old producer had gotten fired from the last iteration of their work at Air America. And they were doing WTF by using their pass cards, which hadn't been deactivated, and just letting themselves into the building late at night. And anyway, Mark moved to Los Angeles. His producer still lives in New York. And so he couldn't – there was no Air America building to let himself into anymore. And so he emailed me because he knew that I was a podcaster, and he said, can you help me get my equipment set up?
Yeah.
And I like told him what microphones to buy and showed him how to use GarageBand. But but he's the one, you know, he's the one with the talent. You know, he's the one that made that show magical.
That show works. It absolutely works. And I was thinking about, you know, I was listening to the Robin Williams interview that he did. And I don't think I had heard a better interview with Robin. To be honest with you, I'm not sure I heard a Robin Williams interview with anyone except for that podcast that really got to the essence of who he was. And I couldn't figure out how he had done it, but it was really remarkable.
You know, Mark is the only interviewer who of whom I know who has similar skills to Mark is Howard Stern. And I know that, as I say, Howard Stern, 35% of the public radio audience just reached reflexively to turn off their car radio. But, you know, the thing about Mark is he's so brutally honest about himself and he's so self-revelatory. And that is a natural thing. That's not a pose for Mark.
No.
You know, if you have him over to your house for dinner, he'll be talking about his deepest fears within 20 seconds.
Right.
And you know, he just assumes that other people will take that tone with him. And in so assuming, people do.
Yeah.
You know, they respond to it that way. I think it's the same way with Howard Stern, who I think is – I'm not a super regular Stern listener, but I do really admire his interviewing. And, you know, one of the things that Stern does is he demonstrates consistently on his show that he will reveal anything about himself,
right,
whether it's flattering or unflattering or crass or, you know, erudite.
Yeah.
You know, he's a really smart guy.
Really.
And – so when he asks that of his guests, which he does persistently over and over, they feel like they have to match. It's something Ira does too. You know, Ira Glass, who's also a big Howard Stern fan.
Yeah.
I think you don't hear it as much because of the way that This American Life is constructed. But Ira is someone who is very open-hearted, and his open-heartedness encourages people to be open-hearted with him. And he's so sincerely interested in other people that it encourages people to be open-hearted with him. I mean, I opened up to him when I was trying to interview him for my show.
Yeah.
He kept asking me questions about it.
Well, I think that it's tough because on one hand, you want to reveal something about yourself. But then at some point also, unless you're incredibly interesting and incredibly witty, it doesn't always work as an interviewing style. You know what I mean? And I think it's not a style that you necessarily adapt. I mean, it's never about you, or not very often about you, at least in a lot of the interviews that you do.
Well, it's funny. I mean, it depends on who you ask. If you compare me, if you compare me to Marc Maron, it's never about me.
Right.
But if you compare me to Terry Gross, it's about me. It's 10,000% more about me than an interview on Fresh Air is. Mm. You know, I think that Terry Gross is another hero of mine. That's not any slight upon Terry, whose first name I use as though I'm friends with her.
Terry.
But me and my pal TG, you know, there's an Terry Gross, I think, is reflective of the historical expectation of public radio that that the host is a sort of invisible proxy for the audience in the way that if you read a Talk of the Town piece in the New Yorker. Mm. They say a reporter visited the Bronx Zoo this past week, and you're like, you visited the Bronx Zoo. The person who wrote this visited the Bronx Zoo, unless you have a third eye watching down on yourself. And I think that, you know, that's a very legitimate way to pursue things. I think I'm sort of somewhere in the middle in that, you know, the show is driven by what I care about and what I believe in and who I am and what I've chosen. You know, we don't even... Honestly, we don't have the staff to have other people choose things. So, you know, it is in some ways about me. And honestly, you know, once in a while we get complaints about that. But I think generally people appreciate something where it comes from an editorial voice that they get to know through this very intimate medium. And so the people who connect with the show connect very deeply.
Well, and then there's the upshot, you know, at the end. I mean, it's that is about you. I mean, that's a recommendation or a reflection. So, yeah, I guess it is about you.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, we actually added the upshot to the show when we were reformatting to make it Bullseye. And I hired my friend Roman Mars to come and help us with that, because while I have been a public radio host since I was 19, I have never had a job in public radio. Yeah. And so I thought maybe someone who knew something about – like I didn't even know how there's this thing in radio called a clock. We didn't have a clock on our show and I had no idea how to do one.
Yeah.
So I hired Roman Mars, who does a brilliant podcast called 99% Invisible, but also had helped create Snap Judgment and helped work on many other amazing shows for PRX and other outlets. And Roman said, you know, this show is about what you like and what you're recommending. And I think that if you have a segment on the show that is that explicitly and specifically, it will help audiences who are used to a relatively impersonal news show on public radio understand where this show comes from. And it's hard. In some ways, I wish I hadn't done it, because to write an essay that recommends something every single week and have it be meaningful every single week requires a lot of depths plumbing of oneself that is, you know, difficult to maintain week after week after week. But on the other hand, that is the segment. Since we added that personal essay to the end of the show, you know, that's the thing that I hear about from people. And I think it's because, you know, it's a direct one-to-one connection between me and the audience. And, you know, it's hard for me to do. And, you know, it's much more raw than most things you'd hear on public radio. But, you know, I also think it's, you know, it's powerful.
Jesse Thorne. He's the host and producer of the radio program Bullseye, which is distributed by NPR. Also hosts a couple of other podcasts, curates a blog about men's style called Put This On. And we have links to all of that on our website, radiowest.org. Speaking of clock, we need to take a break. We'll be back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West on KUER. This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we have with us Jesse Thorne, who is the host and producer of the radio program Bullseye. It's distributed by NPR. He hosts a couple of other podcasts as well. He curates a blog about men's style called Put This On. And he's joining us today from member station KPCC in Pasadena. Jesse Thorne, where did your sartorial style, where did that come from? Was that, I'm going back to your mom again. I mean, she used to make clothing for you. Did it come in part from her, or have you always sort of had a sense of personal style?
Well, I think I've certainly always had a sense of personal style. I've always been a bit of an eccentric dresser. I think, you know, it's funny. I was trying to think of, like, what is the reason behind this? And obviously, my mom, who's you know, even now she's semi-retired from college, but she still works part-time as an antiques dealer. And, you know, she has the most taste of anyone that I've ever known. You know, we even during the times when we were, you know, when I had to pay for my doctor visits with a sticker from the state of California, we always had a beautiful home. And so I think my appreciation of the aesthetic came from her in large part. I think in a funny way, the manner in which I dressed came from the fact that in the neighborhood where I grew up, you know, in the time, it was in some ways when I was a kid, a bohemian neighborhood. But it, you know, it was also, I was born in 1981. You know, it was, I grew up in the midst of the crack epidemic, you know. And I grew up I did not grow up in the projects, but I did grow up across the street from the projects.
Yeah.
And you know, like it was, I was always keenly aware of what gang controlled what territory and what colors I couldn't wear. You know, keenly aware of the ways that being white made me different in my neighborhood. And I think that my, in some ways, survival strategy for me was to look like somebody who definitely wasn't down. Which is to say, be the guy, you know, there's kind of an, there was basically two choices, you know. One was be down and just get in the middle of it and have, you know, have a crew and, you know, have for all the reasons that people, whatever, join gangs and all that stuff. It's because you need somebody to back you up, right?
Yeah.
And the other choice was to sort of separate myself enough that if somebody saw me walking down the street, they wouldn't think that guy's in conflict with me. They would think, huh, look at that guy. you know, like that guy must be visiting.
Right, right. He's not from around here.
Yeah, which by the time I was – I'm a big guy, and by the time I was big was enough to keep me from – you know, I used to get jumped sometimes when I was like – when I was old enough to get jumped, which is, say, probably above 10, you know, nobody's robbing small children. And then until I got big enough to not get jumped anymore because it was too much hassle, which is probably when I was 15 or 16.
Yeah.
But yeah, like to have an identity that was distinct enough that it didn't look like I was trying to be down with the streets was a literal survival strategy for me. So, and it's not one that I think I was super aware of as a kid, although I was certainly aware of what colors I wore and stuff like that. But looking back on it, I realized that, you know, when I was walking down the street and people would be like, "What's up, white boy?" Like that, I had chosen that path relative to you know, pure assimilation in the interest of self-defense. And I was lucky, you know. I mean, talk about white privilege, you know, like I was lucky enough that because of the color of my skin, I could make that choice. You know, that was a choice that was available to me despite the, you know, difficult circumstances that I was in.
You know, I think a part of the appeal for a lot of people who put this on is it's helpful, going back to that idea that, you know, it's useful. But also there's this thing I remember reading in fact, I even wrote this down. David Sedaris had this great line in an essay in The New Yorker about the way people dress on airplanes in the airport. It's as if the person next to you had been washing shoe polish off a pig, then suddenly threw down his sponge saying, I'm going to edit this. Screw this. I'm going to Los Angeles. And I think there's that sense that, come on, people, put a little bit of effort into it. And I think that's what is appealing about Put This On in some way. I mean – I get a sense that people are liking to dress up, men anyway, in a way that they haven't been before. I mean, do you think that's part of the appeal?
I do. I think that's very much the case. I think what you find is that the cultural currency of dressing down is gone.
Yeah.
You know, the baby boomers and even to some extent Generation X could still wring coolness out of not being an IBM technician, you know, not being the classic man in the gray flannel suit, because that was their father, right? And I think that my generation, and I'm like the oldest part of the millennials by most standards, that, you know, I grew up with a dad who you know, I grew up with a dad who was in the Veterans Peace Movement, you know?
Yeah.
Like, there was no rebelling against him being in a suit.
Yeah.
And so there, it's not so much that everyone chooses to dress up, but rather that people have a more – men in particular have a more fluid sense of controlling and asserting their identity through the clothes that they wear. So it is less dictated for them either by society or by a reaction to society, a sort of dictated reaction to society, and more a matter of choice. And so what you find is that, you know, when – if I were to say, you know, one of my sartorial heroes, you know, Andre 3000 from Outkast, you know, when he wears a necktie – he is not wearing a necktie because he wants to fit in at his job at McCann Erickson. It is an expression, and the context of the fact that he has chosen this is important. And so I think that combined with, to some extent, people considering the value of their clothing and choosing higher quality clothing rather than fast fashion, which is, you know, has been the retail trend, you know, as a sort of alternative to fast fashion, which has been the retail trend in the last 15 or 20 years,
right.
And has, you know, pretty much put Abercrombie and Fitch out of business at this point. You know, the kind of thing where you buy 1,000 things that cost $12. So I think those two currents combined to make for a time when more men are comfortable dressing, I don't know what I maybe elegantly would be the way to describe it, including young men.
Do you is it true you wear when you're interviewing someone, you put on a coat and tie?
When I was doing the show out of my apartment, I lived at the time in Koreatown here in Los Angeles, and sort of what you might call a gritty neighborhood, and one in which I am comfortable because of my personal roots, but you know, not every guest was comfortable. And I think I just – when someone showed up and they were there to do a nationally syndicated public radio program and it turned out to be an apartment building in Koreatown, I thought it would be nice if I met them in the lobby wearing a necktie.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Just to let them know that they weren't about to be murdered. I wasn't welcoming them into a Devil in the White City style abattoir house.
What's your go-to suit? Like the suit that you like your favorite? I know you have plenty. I mean, you do a lot of thrifting. You find really great bespoke stuff. But what's the go-to one? The one that you just adore more than anything else?
Geez, it's funny. You know, I actually rarely wear a suit. More often a sport coat or a blazer.
Right.
Because I don't want to be too formal.
No.
But I would say the suit that I own that's closest to my heart, although it's a suit that I wear very rarely, is a suit, a tweed suit, a very heavy tweed suit. I mean, it's got to be 12 or 14 ounce tweed, which is sort of like the weight that you would expect to be on an overcoat or something, that was made to measure for a customer of Abercrombie & Fitch in the 50s.
I've seen a picture of you in this suit, by the way. This is the three-button one?
Yeah. And this suit is, I think it's I want to say 1956 or 1958. It's dated on the inside.
Yeah.
From when Abercrombie and Fitch was still a sort of high-end adventure outfitter.
Right.
And I bought it in a Goodwill in Los Feliz here in Los Angeles. And when I found it, it just blew my mind. And then when I put it on and it fit me, I was like, oh, this is outrageous. But it's something that I can only wear. I mean, I'm not in the country very much, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Kind of an urban dude. And there's not a lot, I don't do a lot of deer stalking.
Right, not a lot of shooting parties.
Yeah, so, you know, we have a sort of conference once a year called Max Fun Con, which is like, it's kind of like summer camp for grown-ups. And it's out in the woods in the mountains of Southern California, and it's kind of cool. The weather's kind of cool usually, and that's when I break it out pretty much once a year, but I do love it. And I figure if I only wear it once a year, I can keep it for the rest of my life.
I wanted to ask you finally. We've got about a minute left. You have this talk that I've read that you developed, a 12-point program called "Make Your Thing." It's where you share what.
So 12 point. Let's be specific. It's a 12-point program for 1,000% absolutely guaranteed success.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wanted to – one of the points that sort of sticks out – I mean, you talk about don't confuse content with and medium, be authentic. And by the way, we should put a link of, because there's a Transom.org published this, which it's terrific. I think it's really great. But I wanted to sort of tease out finally one of these points here, and that is follow your passion. Because in some ways it seems like that has defined your work so far. Is that fair to say?
Yeah. I mean, I think that's something, you know, I mentioned, you know, my father was an organizer in the veterans peace movement for most of his life. And, you know, when I was a kid, he worked with his best friend, Ed Roberts, who was a sort of the Martin Luther King of the independent living movement or rights for disabled people. And, you know, my mother went back to school. Both of my parents went to graduate school when I was a kid, when they were in their 40s. And, you know, we were broke. Both of my parents were broke for the big bulk of my childhood. And that was hard, but it was always clear that it was worth it to do something that was important, and something that was important to you. And, you know, I really believe in that. And I don't even think, you know, make your thing is sort of for how to make money doing what you do. But I don't even think that doing something like that is limited to being a full-time job or being the only thing you do. I think that doing something that you really care about in a way that is committed and craftsmanlike is valuable, whether you work at, you know, whether you work at the grocery store as a bagger and you come home and work on your model train layout, or you know, whatever it is. I just think that caring about something and working very hard on it is you know, one of the things that makes being a human being worth it.
It's Jesse Thorne, hosts and produces the radio program Bullseye, distributed by NPR. His independent radio production group is called MaximumFun.org. We've got links to all of his concerns on our website, RadioWest.org. Jesse, thank you very much for the time.
Oh, thank you so much. It was an honor to be here.
Radio West, a production of KEWR News, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Elaine Clark. I'm Doug Fabrizio.